This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Good morning. It is time for this week's broadcast of Worcester Magazine, your local connection to the news, views, and events happening in Worcester. Today, we will be reading from the May 29th, 2026 edition of Worcester Magazine. This program is brought to you in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind. I'm Julie Standrovich, reading with Catherine Thornton. Thank you for joining us. We begin, as usual, with Wisteria. Exhibit outs spotlight on Worcester's First Lady of Jazz, and this was written by Meg Trigolo. If you were to travel back 100 years in time, you would find the sound of Worcester was hot jazz, played by a six-piece band whose leader was Miriam Mamie Moffett, who always seemed to have a smile on her face when she drove the music from behind her piano. In 2026, when you walk down Main Street and pass the current art show in the Denholm building's facade, you can spot Worcester artist Sammy Bosk's unconventional and lively sculpture of Moffett in the southernmost window. "I just love every picture of her," Bosk said. "Her face is always so bright with this glowing smile. I can absolutely imagine her lighting up a room and playing an amazing set with her band." Bosk's statue wears a long string of pearls, a black and gold outfit, and a laced cape, and the head is a collage of cutouts from jazz LP covers, arranged to make a smiling face. When Bosk first heard about plans for the Uniquely Worcester, celebrating Worcester's past and present art installation at the Denholm, she knew she wanted to create an exhibit that put the spotlight on Worcester's women. And when she learned about Moffett's story, she knew she had a star on her hands. She was a black and native woman in such a time where there was so much segregation and bigotry, and she was a huge inspiration for this whole installation, to really push how innovators have fought through so much to enter these spaces and share their work, Bosk said. The Jazz History Database, an ongoing project based out of Worcester Polytechnic Institute, did some of its first historical research in the early 2000s on Moffett's story, interviewing surviving family members like granddaughter Miriam Estrella, who died in 2019. According to Estrella, Moffett's paternal grandmother, Miriam Johnson Seals, was born on a native reservation somewhere in the Carolinas and sold into slavery as a small child. As an adult, after the Civil War and the abolition of slavery, she, like so many others, headed north in search of better opportunities, and she ended up settling down in New Bedford. Her son, Harrison Seals, would grow up to marry a woman named Esther Fields, who was also of both African and Native descent, and the two of them would go on to raise a big family, including a tremendously musically talented daughter named Miriam, who ended up with the popular nickname Mamie. All teenagers have a first job somewhere, and for Mamie, at the turn of the 20th century, that job was playing live music for students at the New Bedford School of Dance. One gig led to another, and soon she was playing and teaching music for a living. In the 1900s and the 1910s, Mamie was active in New York City's music scene, even briefly teaching legendary percussionist Lionel Hampton, and after divorcing her first husband, she moved north to Worcester with her two daughters and married cornet player Wallace Moffett, just in time to make the 20s roar. In 1922, she and Wallace formed the city's first professional jazz band, Mamie Moffett and her five jazz hounds, bringing the music of the Harlem Renaissance to town, inspiring the coming generation of artists and making Worcester dance. The band stayed together for about 6 years, during which, the Jazz History Database writes, Moffett brought her exceptional musicianship, New York sophistication, years of performance experience, pride in the music of her race, and self-confidence to the leadership of her ensemble. Family friend Ernestine Gray told the Jazz History Database in 2003 that around town, Moffett was known for her ebullient personality and her on-point fashion sense, just as much as for her art. She always looked stylish, stunning, the times that I knew her, and of course I knew her as an older woman, and a lot of space had gone in between Worcester. but she was just classy, Gray said. She made an impression on so many people in her lifetime. I wanted to grow up and be just like her. I admired her doing something exciting, what she wanted to do, and whatever she set her mind to, she did it. A lot of Worcester musicians were paying close attention to the Jazz Hounds in the 20s, including Boots Ward, who would form the Nighthawks, and Jazz Hounds trombonist John Byard's young son, Jakey, who would rise to national fame as a jazz legend in his own right. Some of the artists who met in the crowd would go on to form Worcester's first racially integrated jazz band, the Rocky Blunt All-Stars, who became one of the first bands to do something that everybody in today's local scene does, record their music. Though there are no known surviving recordings of Moffett playing, Bosk said she felt a connection with the long-gone musician right away based on what she knew about jazz. Bosk has synesthesia, a condition where the brain processes sensory input through multiple senses at the same time, and when hearing music, she sees corresponding colors and visuals. Jazz is one of my favorite genres because it tends to be a lot of warm colors, and the movement with which I see those colors can be really neat, Bosk said. The way I hear and interpret jazz is very similar to how people dance and move to the music, which is quite beautiful. It's not always the same with every genre. As Bosk sees it, even the small details of Moffett's story fit right in with all of Worcester's biggest moments. Just look at one of Moffett's business ventures later in life, the Chicken Coop restaurant on Summer Street. Something that I thought was super sweet, because another part of Worcester is all the historic diners here, was how even in her retirement, she had a diner in Worcester before she opened a bed and breakfast in Mashpee, Bosk said. She is always part of the community, providing a welcoming space to the entire community wherever she went. More information about Miriam Mamie Moffett's life and art can be found on the Jazz History Database's website at jazzhistorydatabase.com. And next up, we have an article by Sarah Connell Sanders. Azores trip makes case for vacationing in a volcano. Who better to usher in the age of sparkling water tourism than a girl from Worcester? We Worcesterites know a thing or two about bubbles on account of our fierce devotion to polar seltzer. It's practically a way of life. Imagine my delight when I learned that sparkling mineral water flows freely from a series of natural taps on the Portuguese island of São Miguel. I had to have it. I planned to write, sip, and swim for 5 precious days. The Furnace Valley boasts the highest concentration of hot springs in all of Europe. Throughout my stay in the crater of the Furnace Volcano, I had the frequent urge to dump a box of ziti into the ground and watch it boil. The closest I came was slow cooking a traditional Portuguese stew, cozido, in a hot spring with a group of other writers and creatives from Toronto, New York City, and Lisbon. In the morning, we ceremoniously lowered our pot into a hole, and 8 hours later, we sat exchanging travel stories and enjoying our feast, along with local Azorean wine and grilled pineapple grown right on the island. Warm, iron-rich bass were abundant. My personal favorite was Parca Terra Nostra, where a thermal pool fed by volcanic springs sat in the center of an exquisite botanical garden. When I texted a photo of the latte-toned water home to my family, our daughter responded, "That looks fun, Mama, but I usually swim in blue water." Someday I'll show her what she's missing. When explorers arrived in São Miguel in the 1440s, they found no natural predators, unless you count the volcanic eruptions. The environment remains gentle today. Farmers plant hydrangea bushes in place of cow fences, and the ocean breeze stands in for pesticides. The island feels unspoiled. Ogden Furnace dates back to 1816 as a spa hospital where guests would travel to treat their ailments with a nourishing soak. Currently, it is home to a chic wellness retreat with round-the-clock access to the thermal pools. 40 minutes away, Furnace's sister hotel, Ogden Ponta Delgada, sits in the city center. By splitting my stay on São Miguel between those two properties, I witness the island's dual nature, its dramatic natural beauty, and its cosmopolitan coastal character. My experiences in Furnas and Ponta Delgada were distinct, yet complementary. Most European airlines only fly to the Azores, actually pronounced Azorish, in the summer months, despite the fact that the weather hovers around 60 degrees Fahrenheit all year. That said, it is typical to encounter multiple seasons on any given day, and April showers are reportedly intense. In other words, the weather in the Azorish is consistently inconsistent. Boston is on a short list of cities with year-round direct flights to São Miguel, making travel by SATA and booking a hotel more affordable during the fall, winter, and spring. My flight took under 5 hours. It is quite common in Ponta Delgada to see sperm whales and dolphins if you choose to take a boat ride. Our Futurissimo catamaran didn't use radar or sonar. Instead, the team relied on local scouts with binoculars to locate a variety of mesmerizing sea creatures. That's how we were able to track down the largest mammal in the world, a blue whale, and her calf diving in the ocean at 1,000 meters deep, where the water looked like Yves Klein's blue monochrome. For our final meal, we indulged in Quinta de Jardinet, a family estate that produces classical wines, which expertly express the volcanic terroir of São Miguel. Chef Paulo Lee prepared dry-aged ribeyes over an open flame. Surrounded by vases of fresh flowers inside a candlelit chapel, we toasted to an unforgettable day, still awestruck by the 100-ton giant that had graced our presence mere hours before. Then we bundled up in cozy burrell blankets and took our time gazing at the stars over the vineyard before calling it a night. São Miguel gave me a sensory reset that I will not soon forget, in a destination where the earth quite literally breathes. As I boarded the plane for home, I promised myself that I would someday return to the quiet, untamed heart of the Azores with my family. I hope they hold me to it. Sarah Connell Sanders is an educator and regular columnist for Worcester Magazine. She welcomes followers on Instagram at Sarah_Connell. And next, we have a new column called I Did This Today, which is an occasional column of firsthand experiences titled Spend a Weekend Among Feline Fanciers at Cat Show by Margaret Smith. I knew I'd arrived at the right place when I saw the large green inflatable alien on a post outside the door at the Acadian Social Club in Gardner. The social club was hosting the Out of This World Cat Show, organized by the Long Hair Feline Club, May 23 and 24. The show's alien-based theme included fun images and souvenirs for participants, and all makes sense, especially if you've ever watched the Disney classic, The Cat from Outer Space. It was a Saturday afternoon, and the room was packed with cat owners and breeders and their celebrities, well-coiffed, well-behaved cats of many breeds, getting ready for judging on tiny stages where judges evaluated them according to standards for their particular breed. I've covered my share of cat shows over the years, and here is what I've learned. It's part pageant, part parade, and a fascinating glimpse into heredity and evolution, a process that takes place among living creatures from generation to generation. As Darwin would have it, it's also artificial selection, in which humans promote desirable traits. As such, showing and breeding cats is part science, part history, and totally about a love for cats. It's also hauling crates, cages, grooming supplies, cat toys, and cats across miles for prizes that mainly bring a sense of pride and prestige. The show was hosted by the Cat Fanciers Federation, one of the accredited cat breeder associations, which has strict rules about breeding and a code of ethics and behavior, including limitations on the frequency of breeding of individual animals. Many cat breeders are, at heart, cat lovers. Naming show cats includes the official name of their cattery or breeder, a unique name of their own, and frequently suffixes for titles or changes in ownership. Among those ready to show cats was Wendy Seegers of New Hampshire, who breeds American Curls, who brought Brothers Top Notch, a lilac American Curl known for their ears with slightly curled-in points, and his brother Ragnar with a silver tabby. Of the two, Top Notch is the one who gets shown because his traits and appearance are closest to the standards for the breed. Every breed has a written standard, Seegers said. Seegers said showing American curls represents a challenge. It's harder because they are a rare breed. They're going up against the popular breeds, Maine Coon cats and ragdolls. Seegers' life in the cat show world began when a cat appeared at her door with a striking appearance. Talking with some breeds, Seegers discovered the cat was an American curl. The cat became a beloved pet, and Seegers fell in love with the breed. Many cat shows will have a presence from local animal shelters or collect donations for shelter cats, Seegers said. Seegers also spends a great deal of time rescuing stray cats and caring for them until she can find them placement. People also bring her cats for this reason. Seegers said, in my eyes, all cats deserve a loving home. Heidi Metcalf of North Brookfield is a registered nurse at UMass Memorial Medical Center, an avid cat shower, and makes rosettes for cat show prize winners. I always had cats growing up, said Metcalf, who breeds Persians, known for their long, luxurious fur and their short noses. Metcalf's cat, Muddy Brook Picasso Royal Jewel, was among those vying for prizes. Metcalf said, although cat owners and breeders are competing for ribbons and awards, there is a great sense of camaraderie among cat show folk. For example, if someone runs into trouble grooming a cat's coat, they can get help from their fellow show participants. We all chip in and help each other. We're community-based, said Metcalf. You really build strong friendships as a cat breeder. Cat shows draw both seasoned breeders and showers and the general public, including those for whom a cat show might present a new experience. The very first cat show I covered was a revelation. Among other things, I learned our cat, Pumpkin, a temperamental, passionate, long-haired calico, was probably of Maine Coon cat descent. We learned this when talking to a breeder who noted that these cats, the native cat breed of North America, often splash their water around with their paws, as Pumpkin did. Knocking stuff off the dresser? That was just Pumpkin being Pumpkin. And any cat show I go to, the memory of Pumpkin is sure to trot along with me. Cat show point person Ken Staples said high points for the cat show included winners of best competition and meeting new people and a new crowd who not ever have been to a cat show. And for people traveling from the north, the location was much better because most of our shows are in Rhode Island, so this was closer for a lot of people. Upcoming shows include July 18th and 19th at the Rod and Gun Club in Oxford. Cat shows mean putting in a lot of time and a lot of miles for both humans and cats. But Metcalf said, you really build strong friendships, as well as discovering things about breeds. And next up, we have some Poetry Town for you. This one is titled The Battlefield, written by Thomas F. Gorman III. Fading sunlight ends each day with dappling. Shadows covering gullies of now quiet conflict. The silence of the battlefield ricochets from tree to tree. Fallen leaves bank the roots of oaken centuries. The memories of days of thunder all concentrate now in plots of land sanctified by life's blood. Crimson that once stained this hallowed ground strengthens the roots where freedom grows. Green, now the color of the standard. Rust replaces shining brass. And the weathered wood moans as winds blow past. We come here to sense the glory and the thunder, but remember with reverence and wonder. Thomas F. Gorman III spent 50 years in communication, broadcasting, public relations, public service, and politics before retiring. He now spends his time writing short stories, poetry, and haiku, and has completed 4 novels, all seeking a publisher. Several of his poems have been published locally, Worcester Magazine, and nationally, The Ranger's Almanac. His short story, A Classless Reunion, will appear in a crime anthology by Murderous Ink Press, UK, a member of the Academy of American Poets and the Worcester County Poetry Association. He lives with Janice, his wife of 50-plus years, and has 2 grown daughters and 5 grandchildren. All right. Now we are going to send you over to Catherine, who has some more articles from Worcester Magazine queued up.
Starting off with Joe Fusco, first person column. Joe Fusco Jr., chiropractor, reach across the table. My chiropractor is a mime. At least, that's what I thought he was during my first visit. He just pointed at the table and waved for me to lie on it. He then tapped the back of my head when our 9-minute session was over. He exchanged nods, and when I left the room, I asked his receptionist about the silent treatment. He's a less-is-more healer, she replied. My chiropractor giggles like a schoolboy. On my second visit, we went over my extensive medical history. He seemed to find my 12 surgeries extremely amusing. To see this 40-something, 6'3", 240-pound healthcare professional admit a hee-hee intermittently during our conversation made me long for the silent treatment again. My chiropractor uses an activator during our 9-minute sessions. It makes a clicking sound as he moves it from my lower back to my shoulders. It makes me feel like the cardboard box they stapled together at FedEx to ship my old cable box back to Spectrum. My chiropractor operates a drop table during our 9-minute sessions. I have spinal arthritis, so the sudden descents and ascents of the table act like a thrill ride to my lower extremities. I admit to emitting a few hee-hees during the treatment. It's like Space Mountain for seniors. My chiropractor surprised me with a standing bear hug at the end of our third 9-minute session in an apparent effort to correct my poor posture. My right shoulder, which underwent rotator cuff surgery in 2007, immediately responded in a negative fashion. I'm scheduled for a cortisone shot in the shoulder from my orthopedic surgeon 2 weeks from tomorrow. I contacted one of those billboard lawyers, and I told Dr. Hehe to lay off the upper extremities in the meantime. My chiropractor wore a blue New York Giants polo shirt at our fourth 9-minute session. I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut, and have been a Big Blue fan all my life. My dad took me to Giants games as a kid at the old Yankee Stadium. I went to every miserable home game from 1973 to 74 when they played at Yale Bowl while Yankee Stadium was being renovated. I've rooted for Frank Gifford, Homer Jones, Fran Tarkenton, Phil Sims, Lawrence Taylor, Eli Manning, and the current very mediocre squad. I need a cold shower after the 2 Super Bowl wins over Tom Brady and the Patriots. I love your shirt, I told Dr. Hehe as he used the activator on my back. Big blue all the way, he replied. On the ride home, I canceled the billboard lawyer. Maybe the good doctor is a Yankees fan, too, I thought to myself, then touched my right shoulder. It felt much better. World of Food Festival to bring global flavors to Elm Park by Meg Tricolo. Worcester's summer festival season will open June 6th with the 4th annual World of Foods Festival, which will bring dishes from more than 25 countries to Elm Park for an afternoon of culinary world travel. For co-founder Carolyn Castillo, who has long organized various events in the city, it's always a thrill as she's an avid traveler with a taste for anything new. Because I've worked with so many different cultures, I knew what I wanted to do, something that would include all the cultures instead of just mine. I went with the world, Castillo said. A global experience. At World of Foods, each country or culture is represented by one food stand or truck. This year's field, comprising more than 24, covers a wide swath of the globe, including India, Cuba, Armenia, Colombia, Thailand, Spain, Jamaica, Mexico, Vietnam, Dominican Republic, where Castillo grew up. Sometimes we might have 2 vendors from the same country, but they represent a different menu. We might have a Brazilian restaurant that's just doing a main course or appetizers, and another Brazilian restaurant that's focusing on desserts. Castillo said the format both makes for a little bit of everything at the festival and benefits the vendors, which are all small, Worcester-based, and still within their first 5 years of doing business. The menus are not doubled. there's only one vendor that will have each item. If you want an empanada, there's only one that will have the specific empanada because our goal is that everyone sells out. It's a good combination. In addition to the food, more than 70 small local craft vendors, including artists, clothing brands, soap makers, booksellers, and jewelers, will set up shop alongside a parade of sponsors that include Centro, Quinsigamond Community College, Clark University, the YWCA of Central Massachusetts, Face Painters, an arts bus, a bouncy house, and one of the Worcester Public Library's bookmobiles will be on the scene to provide fun and entertainment for families with children. Board games will be available for all to borrow and play on their picnic blankets. The festival will also take advantage of its location in what is probably Worcester's main gathering place for dominoes players, holding a dominoes tournament judged by two referees and offering a cash prize to the winner. A response to COVID losses. Like so many new ideas of the past 5 years, the World of Foods Festival was a direct response to the losses of the COVID-19 pandemic. Castillo and co-founder Lisa Dobson organized the first World of Foods in October 2023 in hopes of bringing back big events to Elm Park, which due to its size, location, trails, and playground, draws visitors every day from as close as across the street and as far as out of town. I live around Elm Park, and we used to have a lot of events before COVID. I used to love the ice cream festival they had, and that's gone. After COVID, the city didn't make it easy to actually get that park for events, and you can see it because we don't have that many events happening there. According to Castillo, the inaugural World of Foods Festival drew about 40 vendors, including both food and craft businesses. Less than 8 months later, the second edition in June 2024 featured about 130. We have had over 1,000 visitors every year. Last year it was a little bit hectic because there was rain, but usually we get a lot of visitors. Elm Park is a very high traffic park as it is, so when there's an activity there, it's very well attended. One thing that Castillo particularly loves about the festival is its 40 to 50 person volunteer staff is always made up of mostly students from Daugherty Memorial High School and Worcester Tech. Some of those students built the festival signage, and Worcester Tech's Culinary Arts Department has been present each year so far. I go to the business fairs they have, and all the students will say, "I know the event is coming up. I want to be part of it." That's something that makes me very happy and fills my cup, because I can help them with their resume, and they can use those volunteer hours and say they have participated in major events like this. However, it's the international representation plus the location, two things Castillo came to value partly through her work in home nursing, that make the festival unique. Going into people's homes, seeing all different regions of Worcester, I know the community, I know every area, I know every neighborhood. Elm Park is something that attracts everyone, Castillo said. In my opinion, if I did this event at Institute Park or in Maine South, it wouldn't be as big. It wouldn't attract as many people. But this is very central. Everyone can come here. The Foods Festival, noon to 6 p.m. on June 6th, Elm Park on Russell Street in Worcester, and that event is free. You're listening to a reading of Worcester Magazine, a production of Audio Journal. And speaking of parks, Worcester Walks, Meg Trigolo writes, "Shh, this way to the secret garden." Some things are more than they appear at first glance, and what may seem like an unassuming short half-mile trail along the edge of Hills Farm Pond in Shrewsbury is the path that will take you to the secret garden, a combination outdoor art gallery, fairy tale shrine, and green oasis beneath tall trees. Not that it's easy to miss the art, even while walking by the pond. Even as you enter from the northern trailhead on Cherry Hill Road, you'll begin running into stone carvings, a rabbit holding two fistfuls of roses, an owl, a floppy-eared basset hound, two children reading on a bench. If that's not enough to tip you off, you'll soon reach a bridge above the spot where the pond drains into a stream that has tall metal railings in the shape of tree trunks and is decorated with mosaics and carved stones. Beyond the bridge, a bower stands by the burbling stream. This trail is the gateway into the secret garden, where you can sit at picnic tables in an open area where colored glass is embedded in the dirt, or you can take the plunge into the greenery and into neighbor Robert Chief Joseph Turkanian's artistic vision. Turkanian, an art lover who lives next to the forest on Cherry Street, has been filling Shrewsbury's public and green spaces with sculptures for decades, and over the years, his backyard gallery of art, both high and low, has become a destination. Along the garden path, a few of the many, many things you will find include a life-sized horse, wind chimes everywhere, a red and white Santa Claus statue, plaques on tree trunks bearing live, love, laugh, style, motivational quotes, and a gorilla striking a remarkably sassy pose. Some of the trinkets farther out of the garden's core seem to be contributed by visitors, like a fairy doll we spotted perched in a hollow tree trunk, or a little stack of colorful animal figurines left on top a stone wall. On the day we went, there were also what looked like tiny Lego figures of Jesus on top of almost every carved stone sculpture. Farther downstream from the bower, a chair and a bench sit opposite each other in a tiny clearing, perfect for settling in to hang out with any friends that appreciate a good oddity. When Worcester Magazine visited, though, it was late morning on a weekday. We shared the trails with many others, a couple chatting at a picnic table, a mother letting her curious child explore, a neighbor walking his poodle. Given the warm weather and proximity to standing water, pack your bug spray when you visit the secret garden, and if it has rained recently, wear shoes you don't mind getting muddy. If you're not quite done with childlike whimsy yet after wandering the trails, hop over to the Heber Candy Mansion around the corner on Route 20. Street parking is available on Stony Hill Road and in the cul-de-sac at the end of Cherry Hill Road in Shrewsbury. And now for the food scene. Barbara Hull writes, Indian Bites delivers Indian fast food at Worcester Public Market. Indian Bites is a new restaurant at the Worcester Public Market celebrating a May 22nd grand opening after a week-long trial run. The business is promoted as the sister location to Desi Bar and Grill in Worcester. The authentic Indian fast food restaurant offers a bold and diverse menu for dine-in and take-out, according to manager Alicia Dakam. Kabjin Bujel of Worcester and Partners opened Desi Bar and Grill on Chandler Street in late December 2024, specializing in North Indian and Nepal cuisines. Bujel, with business partners and longtime friends Amardeep Singh, Sushant Puri, and Raghubir Thakur, planned for Indian Bites. The men are both entrepreneurs, culinarians, according to Alicia Dakal, daughter of Raghubir Thakur. Her father also is chef owner of Singh's Cafe in Wellesley. Indian Bites took over the spot vacated by Namaste Wu. The restaurant has inside seating for 20, with seasonal street-side tables. Diners can also use the public market's large central food court seating area. The restaurant is open from 11 a.m. to 10 p.m., Monday through Thursday, 11 a.m. to 11 p.m., Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. The schedule differs from the public market's hours. Diners use the restaurant's side entrance on Harding Street when the public market is closed. Food served at Indian Bites is based on family recipes made with passion and quality ingredients, according to owners. There are classic favorites, vegetarian specialties, freshly made naan and samosas prepared daily. Bombay chicken, a chicken Sikh skewer kebab made with desi spices, served with a choice of topping and sauces, already is a customer top pick. It's one of four Indian Bites specials, ranging from $5.95 to $9.99, that include chicken puffs, paneer puffs, that are cottage cheese mixed with Indian spices and filled in puffs and baked, and OMG peri peri fries, which are potato fries tossed in cheese dust. The selection of appetizers on the menu are perfect for the whole table. The menu also features biryani, chicken and vegetable, chicken wings. 9 Indian bowls showcase a spectrum of flavors from salmon, lamb and goat to chicken China, butter chicken and Gobi Manchurian. All bowls are served with a long grain basmati rice. The day we interviewed at Indian Bites, Kabin Bujel from Desi Bar and Grill dropped by. He said one of the reasons he and his partners decided to open at Worcester Public Market is that it's a year-round central place of diverse owner-operated businesses. There's retail, but the market is definitely a food destination, he said. There's a lot of community support. We're very happy with our spot, and I think Desi customers will check us out when they're in the Canal District area. This summer, check social media for local festivals and special events planned in and around the city. According to Dakar, Indian Bites and Desi Bar and Grill, look to possible vendor spots and will announce participation on social media. In the meantime, enjoy authentic international food offered not only at the Worcester Public Market, but throughout the city. And now for this week's cover story, Coming of Age.
You are listening to Worcester Magazine, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. And now it's time for this week's cover story. A need right now for young voices. WSU grad Alex Lucier talks about his film A Summer Interlude by Richard Duckett. In Summer Interlude, a film by Gardner native and Worcester State University grad Alex Lucier, a recent high school graduate faces a life-defining question at the end of summer. Levi, an aspiring filmmaker, has been rejected by the film school he wanted to get into. Should he follow the wishes of his parents and go into the community college in the small coastal Maine town he wants to get out of? Or should he follow the path of Sarah, a free-spirited woman he has just gotten to know? It's a coming-of-age drama, said Lucier, who is also a graduate student at WSU. Summer Interlude is Lucier's first full-length feature film, and the verdict on it is already in. It won the Outstanding Achievement Award for Best New England Feature at the Massachusetts Independent Film Festival held in Worcester in April, the first film festival where Summer Interlude had been screened. Lucier has entered the film into other film festivals, and it will screen as an official selection at the Vacation Film Festival on August 21 to 23 in Biddleford, Maine. Filming took place in June 2024, followed by a long period of editing. There were so many crazy things to get it together, Lucier said. Summer Interlude evolved from a class assignment at WSU into an extracurricular independent feature. Lucier credits Brittany Severance, assistant professor of communication at WSU, and a well-regarded multimedia artist and filmmaker with mentoring him and making Summer Interlude possible. The only reason the movie ever happened, he said. I'm so happy for Alex, said Severance. He's worked very hard for the recognition. The whole process was not something that could have been predicted when Lucier graduated from Gardner High School and contemplated college. Lucier did not go to WSU intending to become a filmmaker. I hadn't studied film until sophomore year of college. I was more interested in photography. He was a communication major, graduating in 2025. As a graduate student at WSU, he is studying public policy. He does have a background as a photographer and said he took every class in photography that was available at Gardner High. At the suggestion of his advisor at WSU, he took a class in video production taught by Severance. The WSU photography/video production studios are considered state-of-the-art. Lucier enjoyed the video production class. It was cool, he said. So the next semester, he took Severance's screenwriting class. The first script he wrote, I had a hard time with it. For the second, I wrote something I could picture writing. He knew Maine. I was picking places I had seen. He also knew how people his own age feel. The script was the basis of what would become the first act of Summer Interlude. The story is not autobiographical, Lucier said. It's parts of different people I know. It's representative of people our age. People have told me they can see themselves in different characters in the film. Severance was impressed when she first read what Lucier had written. There was a lot of potential. He wrote it from his own perspective, she said. Lucier also took independent studies with Severance. Even so, Lucier had not initially thought that what he had written could be made into an actual movie. Then, in the spring semester of 2024, the summer interlude project did indeed come together. A lot of things happened. I spent the entire spring semester really scrambling, working with Professor Severance, he said. With Severance's help, grants and support for making the movie came from the Summer Undergraduate Research Grant and Worcester State Foundation Student Research Award. Lucier also launched a crowdfunding campaign and put in some personal funds. With Lucier as writer, producer, and director, a filming schedule was set up for June 2024 that included a location weekend in Maine and elsewhere. Scenes were shot on York Beach, the Salisbury Beach Boardwalk, and York's Wild Kingdom Zoo and Amusement Park. On different occasions, scenes were also filmed in Gardner and Worcester. Actors for the cast of Five were found through Backstage, a casting platform. We had so many submissions, we auditioned a lot of people for a long time, Lucier said. For the two main roles, we had over 20 for each, which was crazy. Aiden Levinson was cast as Levi, and Madison Campbell got the role of Sarah. We ended up with two incredible actors as the leads. Severance said Lucier asked if I would do the camera work. So she came on board as the film's cinematographer and also as an associate producer. But she said of Lucier, he really led the charge. That included getting filming permits and arranging filming times. Lucier and Severance went to a town meeting in Salisbury to get permission to film on the Salisbury Beach Boardwalk, Severance recalled. We waited a long time to find out if we had the permits or not to film the scenes. The total cast and crew numbered up to 20 at various points and included several students. For the weekend in Maine, catering had to be arranged. A budget of $20,000 was below the bare minimum of what it should have cost, Lucier said. But it seems as if all the people involved were a happy and creative group. I think the most rewarding part for me was actually being there and doing it, Lucier said. When people see the film, I hope you can see how much fun we had making it, he said. The project was done in the collaboration of having fun, working hard, and putting their passion in the project. It built a community, Severance said. As a professor, it was an important moment to see my students create something and feel accomplished. After the filming, Lucier engaged a composer to work on a score. Editing began in the fall of 2024. I said, be prepared, it's a lot of work, Severance said. All told, the editing process, including sound and color mix, took over a year and a half, a period of time far from unusual for most films, Lucier noted. It can take you many months, Severance said. When I saw the final version with the music, I was proud of the entire team. Alex, but also everyone who had a part in all the efforts to produce the project, Severance said. Looking at the film now, Lucier said, you can nitpick forever. I'm hoping I can sit back and enjoy it. I'm so grateful to every other single person on the set or every other person who helped fund it. It takes an entire community to make it happen. Lucier started submitting summer interlude to film festivals at the beginning of the year, and the Massachusetts Film Festival accepted it right away. Severance's 2023 short film, A Momentary Stop, had previously won Best Worcester County Short at the Massachusetts Independent Film Festival, so both have achieved success at the event. It's exciting. It's going to be fun for me, Lucier said, of following the future progress of Summer Interlude. There's a need right now for young voices, he said. A lot of films about young people are being told by people older than us. Skip Shea, organizer of the Massachusetts Independent Film Festival, said, I thought Summer Interlude is a unique coming-of-age story, as Alex wrote and directed it while experiencing that transition. Coming-of-age films are generally made by artists looking back at their own experiences. This happened in the immediate, which keeps its perspective of that moment when youth step into adulthood, which makes it authentic. Lucier still isn't quite sure yet if his future is in filmmaking. He plans to keep studying public policy at WSU for his master's degree. He was also previously an intern in the mayor of Gardner's office. I'm not quite ready to jump ship. Right now, we'll see how it goes through the film festival circuit. I'd definitely love to, but I'm keeping my options open. I'm trying to figure out where I end up. Does Severance think Lucier has a future as a filmmaker? Absolutely, I think he has a future, she said. I think whatever Alex decides to do with his career, he will go at it with tenacity. And that wraps up this week's cover story. Now we send you back over to Catherine for some more articles from Worcester Magazine.
We next have a column by Margaret Smith. Museum in Tewksbury offers journey through public health history. On the grounds of Tewksbury Hospital sits a quiet portal to the past, easy to overlook, but once visited, never forgotten. The Public Health Museum, an independent nonprofit, lies within the historic Richard Morris Building on the hospital campus. It's a place where the visitor can travel back in time to early days of efforts to prevent the spread of disease, to treat mental illness, and ensure the well-being of everyone. The museum also shows some mistakes and controversies, some tragic along the way, including in the treatment of mental health. The museum's newly redesigned nursing exhibit entitled Care, Compassion, and Dedication, A History of Nursing, illustrates the crucial role women have played in public health, surveying a history of the nursing profession from the Revolutionary War to the post-World War II era. The exhibit highlights influential nursing figures who have shaped the profession, particularly women, who have not only been givers of care, but led the way to changes and growth. Museum volunteers, retired nurses among them, will add to the exhibit, said Amber Woods, museum coordinator, a friendly and very helpful person who met with me when I arrived at the museum and who wrote thoughts later to share in this column. Humans versus Invisible Killers. An exhibit on infectious disease will strike a chord both for the historical struggle against ancient diseases such as smallpox and the modern pandemics, AIDS and COVID. An iron lung, a tube-shaped capsule that helped polio patients to breathe properly, stands in the center. In a time in which ancestral memory often seems to vanish in the haze of social media overload, this is an artifact to make time stand still. Polio is not eradicated, but far fewer people live in fear of it, thanks to the vaccine that virtually stopped the disease in its tracks. Smallpox is no longer found anywhere among human populations after a worldwide vaccination campaign led to its official eradication in 1980. But the exhibit gives insight into the terror of this disease across centuries of civilization. Part of the exhibit looks at public responses, including to the 1918 influenza epidemic and pandemics closer to us in time, HIV, AIDS, and COVID. Because the science of infectious disease epidemiology isn't just about the microbe in the microscope, attitudes and behavior shape the path the agents through which disease spreads or is contained. Although not limited in potential exhibit topics when it comes to infectious disease, the museum highlights these specific subjects because of the pivotal role that public health played in how these diseases and medicines affected communities. Mental health as part of health. Mental health today has garnered much greater understanding, including the relationship between body and mind, the interaction of the brain and central nervous system with a person's environment as important indicators of mental illness. And human beings have always tried to understand mental illness, its causes and treatment, including beliefs that supernatural factors might play a role, or an imbalance of bodily ailments called humors. An exhibit on mental health shows the rocky course of the science of mental health, including the tragedies of institutional care, in which patients were subject to treatments that were cruel, as well as ineffective, and sometimes restrained in their beds. It's an unfinished story, as we are using our brains to learn more about how to keep them healthy. I asked Woods what makes the museum a special place to work. Woods began working at the museum in 2021 and said, among the museum's exhibits, the infectious disease room is my favorite. I have long been interested in epidemiology, and during my undergraduate studies in archaeology, I became fascinated by the role disease played in shaping ancient cultures. The museum offers tours to individuals and groups, but notes if you're a paranormal researcher, the museum gets many requests, but does not offer tours for this purpose. Hopeful for the future. I grew up in a public health family in which both parents were nurses, and such an upbringing will turn you into an epidemiology geek in short order. The parts of the exhibit dedicated to AIDS and COVID resonated with a journalist's own journey writing about illnesses, including those with mysterious origins, and about which little was known, and how political and cultural responses could help or tragically hinder the quest for answers. Woods said, beyond the exhibit themselves, the most rewarding aspect of working at the museum is interacting with high school students. Their curiosity and engagement make the work incredibly fulfilling and leave me hopeful for the future, especially as some of them may one day become the next generation of public health leaders. To lead the way for the future of health, a good place to start is with a bit of time travel. The Public Health Museum is located at Tewksbury Hospital on East Street in Tewksbury. The hours are 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Thursdays and Saturdays. General admission is $10 and tours are available. This week's last call is written by Margaret Smith, Joyce Augustus, entrepreneur and nonprofit leader. After graduating college, Joyce Augustus took up her roommate's offer to move to central Massachusetts, and here Augustus found her destiny. Augustus, founder and president of J. Cassand, Inc., online fashion retail store, grew up in the Caribbean, and now a long history of leadership in area nonprofits, including the YWCA of central Massachusetts, Massachusetts Women of Color Coalition, E for All, which supports entrepreneurs, and the United Way. Augustus recently shared her experiences as a panelist for Conversations for Change, organized by the Worcester Women's History Project, held April 29th at Worcester Public Library, focusing on issues of race and gender. Augustus recalled working for the YWCA Central Massachusetts in accounting when Lyndia Cavioli, the now retired executive director, asked her to join the board. Augustus is especially proud of the capital campaign for the YWCA renovation project, with its leadership comprised of women. You talked about many things relating to young women at the panel. Tell me more about that. Right now, I'm also on the board of MAWOCC, Massachusetts Women of Color Coalition. They launched the Intergenerational Leadership Academy for young girls of color to edify them around different things, how to become a professional leader within the community, how to use their strengths to get ahead, and encourage them to do things that they embrace, the things they value, to make a difference in the community. One of the reasons I got involved in that was that when I was growing up, I didn't have folks like myself to share and mentor. Now that I have that experience, I want to share that with young girls of color. Things like economic empowerment, sustainability. That's important, especially for young women of color. Contribute to the economic growth for the community, and things like that are empowering. How to take care of your health and wellness. What's your voting rights? Let young girls know they can vote once they come of age. Nothing is stopping them. All of this is empowering to them to be the best they can be and at what they do, to be the best version of themselves, not to be afraid, to go out there and trust that decisions they make, they will follow through with that. I do the same thing in the United Way with the Women's Initiative Dollar Scholar Program. It's a similar group of diverse young girls, grades 9 through 12, and just mentoring them through what is a budget, saving money, having money, showing them what a salary would look like should they choose a career path. What are you going to spend it on? important things like your rent, making sure you can budget for food, education, vacation, putting money away for your retirement. Those are some of the things I talk about and mentor young girls. At the panel, you were talking about a particular meeting concerning the YWCA board where you were trying to say something, and this stayed with me. Can you tell me more about that and what you learned from that? I think Linda was sitting and observing interactions around the table. She noticed several times that I was going to say something, but other people didn't realize I was going to speak up. She pounded on the table and said, "Joyce, you need to speak up." She knew what I was trying to do. "You have a voice. You need to speak up." I said, "Well, I was trying to be polite." And sometimes you have to take that authority and take that initiative and overcome that hurdle, but not disrespect others and find your voice. Find a way to jump right in. It was just learning from that experience and her sharing that in order for you to have a good voice, a strong voice, you have to be a little more assertive. It has nothing to do with disrespecting others, but knowing when to get right in. As part of the Worcester community, you've become part of the community. Why is it important to you to build things and be part of things? When I came to Worcester, I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do, where I wanted to be, actually, so I came here with my roommate from college. I studied in Puerto Rico, and her fiancé lived in Massachusetts, in Clinton, and so she asked me what was I going to do after graduation. I said, "I'm not quite sure. Why don't you come after me? You know, let's take that journey." Worcester is a small community. There was just something about it that made me want to stay. There's a lot of history in Massachusetts, so it was intriguing. And knowing, let's say, that the Kennedys are from Massachusetts, growing up, my mom had a JFK bust on the mantle. Here I am, in the state where he was from, at Mechanics Hall. Do you know how many people have stood at that podium? I think Worcester is a beautiful gateway to diversity and welcoming to people of all diverse backgrounds, whatever culture they're from, and just make them feel comfortable. You have been listening to a reading of Worcester Magazine, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Catherine Thornton, reading with Julie Standrovich. Thank you for listening.
What's your vision?
My vision is 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye, zero vision in the left eye.
No. What's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work.
Financial independence.
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, we believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/mcb.
Welcome to Everyday Poems for Everyday, sponsored by Audio Journal. Our poem today is actually a sonnet. It's Sonnet 98 by William Shakespeare. From you have I been absent in the spring, when proud, pied April, dressed in all his trim, hath put a spirit of youth in everything. That heavy Saturn laughed and leaped with him. Yet nor the lays of birds, nor the sweet smell of different flowers in odour and in hue, could make me any summer's story tell, or from their proud lap pluck them where they grew. Nor did I wonder at the lily's white, nor praise the deep vermilion in the rose. They were but sweet, but figures of delight, drawn after you. You pattern of all those. Yet seemed it winter still, and you away, as with your shadow I with these did play. You've been listening to Everyday Poems for Everyday, sponsored by Audio Journal, and read by me, Nikki Wichelow. Thanks for listening, and may your life be filled with the magic of poetry.